The title of this session is called Raising Taxes, the Easy Way to Lose Elections. It's supposed to be a talk on taxes, spending, and government investment. And I'm John Marty. For those who haven't come to any of my sessions yet, I'm a state senator in Minnesota, not a U.S. senator. So I work on state policy there, and picked a topic for the last one of my sessions on the hottest political issue around. Wasn't sure if this was going to have nobody show up or a packed room, and it's somewhere in between. I would make the suggestion that taxes is year in and year out consistently the hottest political issue. There are times when another issue will eclipse it, and that happens frequently, but it's always the second or third hottest issue on voters' minds in elections, and in any political discussions, it's always one of the main ones. And that's true not just over time, it's also consistent from state to state. I think most states have similar kinds of debates over taxes, and every level, national level, state, and local, it's a hot one. And I'd argue that while there's this ongoing dislike of taxes, nobody wants to pay them, there are intense periods of tax revolt in between. Probably the best known ones of the last couple of decades are first California's Proposition 13, and a couple years later there were followed through a whole bunch of other ones, like Massachusetts had I think they called it Proposition 2.5 to limit property taxes to, I guess it was 2.5% of market value or something. And I would suggest that these intense tax revolts, the times where taxes takes on a major, the number one overriding issue, those things occur, although most people generally don't like taxes, most people pay them, and somewhat willingly, because it is, there are a lot of ways somebody can cheat on their taxes, and while many people certainly may cheat on their taxes, the bulk of the public, I think, willingly, not eagerly, but willingly pays their taxes, because our system basically has to rely on compliance, voluntary compliance. Sure, some people are going to get caught through audits, but a lot of them aren't, and I think people, there is a lot more voluntary compliance when people feel they're getting their money's worth or whatever, and there is generally a public acceptance of taxes in our country. I would suggest that the tax revolts grow when one of two things occur. One, when the public perception, and it doesn't have to be reality, it can, but not necessarily be reality, that the public thinks that tax dollars are not wisely spent. Or number two, when people feel they are not paying their fair share. And on the first of these two issues, the money being poorly spent, waste in government, attitudes about waste, I would argue, are very much strengthened by politicians of both political parties who promote discussion of waste in government basically to boost their own political career. I mean, I'd be stupid if I didn't go out there and sometimes talk about eliminating waste in government, even if I didn't think there was any waste in government, and that's not what I feel. It's just I'm saying there are politicians who will exaggerate the point. They will focus on that to the exclusion in an unrealistic way. They will act as if, well, if only we get rid of this waste in government, then we'll have far more than enough money to take care of all of our problems and cut taxes all at the same time. In the last election, my opponent, the attacks he made on me were only on tax and spending issues. He had proof that I didn't spend enough money for education. He had several votes to show I voted against additional funding for education. He had votes to show I didn't want to spend more money on health care. He had votes to prove I didn't do enough for nursing homes, for environmental protection. You name it, he had about 10 or 12 issues, and every one of them, the problem with me was I wouldn't spend enough money on them. And then he gets to the tax issue, and boy, I've helped make Minnesota one of the highest states in taxes in the country, and it's all my fault. And in our debates, which we had several of, it was interesting. One of them, the final debate we had, it was great. several of the audience questions, two of them, one person asked one, and then there was a written one that had been submitted earlier. The moderator said, wait, this sounds very similar to that. And they were, to my opponent, well, if you think he doesn't spend enough money in this area, and this area, and this area, listed the areas the two questions said, and they both added on to each other, the whole bunch of them, and you think that your opponent is too much in favor of high taxes, how are you going to balance the budget, since you say the budget's out of balance? And his comments in that one were, well, first of all, he's a good manager. He's got 41 years of experience in the business world, and he knew how to get the book straight real quickly, and he would do a great bang-up job on it. And then, well, the moderator followed up for the questioners. But I mean, how are you going to do that? You're saying we need to spend more in all these areas and we've got to tax less. And his response was priorities. And I had the response to his. I was the second responder. And I basically said, you know, it sounds to me his priorities are whatever somebody asks him about. In the debate, one or two new areas had come out about other areas, and his solution was we ought to spend more on them. And the nature of that, my response was that any area that somebody talked about was a priority to him at the time, and basically it was a lot of double talk. But people of both parties, incumbents and challengers, all make the same kind of arguments. You read political columns or brochures from incumbents and challengers alike, and you get the feeling that they're spending full time trying to spend more and tax less, all of which while being fiscally responsible and coming up with a balanced budget. And it doesn't work that way. So where are they going to do it? Well, as my opponent said, he'd do it by prioritizing, though he didn't list anything that wasn't a priority for him, other than waste. And they say waste all the time. We're going to get rid of waste in government. And I would make the argument that if there was such a large quantity of waste in government, and I can point out several things in Minnesota state government and a good number of things in the federal government too that I'd say are wasteful. You total them all up together, it's going to be a small fraction of the budget. And that's not to say that it shouldn't be a high priority to get rid of it. It's simply to say that overemphasis on it makes the public believe that their dollars are being very poorly spent. And if there was this large quantity of waste, somebody, somewhere, some reporter, something would go out there and show how in a state budget worth billions of dollars, how $1, $2, $3 billion were being wasted. Instead, they'll show $70,000 wasted on this, and in their mind, the $2 million project that they don't think was a great idea. And you total those things up, it may be several million dollars, but you got to get $1,000 million to get to $1 billion. And in a budget of two-year budget of about $15 billion, talking about a couple hundred million. Which I would argue is a lot more than they're going to find, is not the way you're going to balance a budget. You're not going to be able to do all the things politicians promise to the public, and you're not going to be able to cut taxes all at the same time just by getting rid of that waste. Having said that, I would argue that as one who thinks government has some major roles in terms of addressing social problems and in providing government services, I would argue that the importance of cutting government waste is far greater than the dollar value attached to it. And the dollar value, if in Minnesota, if I could do certain things and eliminate $20 million, $200 million from the state budget through wasteful things, not talking about programs that we might debate whether we think the state should do it. Should the state be investing in a new historical society building, which we are doing in Minnesota? I think you can make arguments on both sides of that, and truly, the politician who wants to be fiscally conservative and cut money should argue against those kind of things, but it's interesting how the ones who often talk the most about waste and cutting spending, as soon as they have somebody write them about how the historical society really is out in a poor position, needs more space and so on, they're the first ones to volunteer that, yeah, that should be a high priority, and they agree with it. But again, I would argue that the importance of cutting waste is goes beyond the value of the dollars involved because it builds that public cynicism, which I think is very dangerous in a democracy. They have a public that's very cynical. They think their government's a terrible waste of money, a terrible fraud. All the politicians involved are a bunch of self-serving crooks. Once you get to that stage, people lose interest in their government. They don't participate in the electoral process. They give up on the voting. And so that cynicism is important to fight. And therefore, I would argue that government, even if it costs a significant amount of time and effort to root out waste, even small amounts of waste, it's worth doing. And I can give you a number of examples, most of them fairly small in Minnesota, that I would fight. And some of them are things that were done several years ago. One, our Historical Society, in conjunction with the Capitol Area Board that runs the state capitol complex, they did several renovations to the Capitol, several things to restore it to historical accuracy and so on. And one of the more disgusting ones in my mind was they spent $50,000 on the number of marble ashtrays, marble ashtray garbage cans, which are very unfunctional. You can hardly get garbage in without gouging your hand on the brass edges. And ashtrays outside of the building because there's no smoking in our Capitol. And that was a big scandal at the time. They bought 25 waste baskets at $2,000 a piece. That's outrageous. I think they're ugly things. I think square marble boxes with ashtrays on tops are kind of ugly. They're gaudy, I guess would be the best term for them. They're very expensive, and I'd argue $2,000 a crack. We have far more urgent things to do in state government. And they're not very functional, so they serve no great purpose. And in a government that's financially pressed, as all governments are, I would say it was a stupid thing to do. That was about 4 years ago. And I think it was a stupid thing to do then. I still do. I don't think we should throw out the garbage cans now that we have them. But Newsweek, apparently your timer, Newsweek did a story on four states and how they addressed the state budget crises this year. Minnesota was one of them they picked, and they said, well, Minnesota may not have done a good job because they addressed a large part of their problem by raising the taxes. This was a news story, not editorial, though it kind of had that flavor. And the proof of it was there was a lot of waste in Minnesota government. One of the two or three examples of it was these marble ashtray garbage cans. That was 4 years ago, $50,000. And again, I agree with them. I agree that was a terrible waste of money. So we could save $50,000 then. And I'm glad the example gets brought up from time to time so we can show that there are things we should do differently. But having said that, $50,000 in a $15 billion biennial budget isn't going to balance the books by getting rid of that kind of thing. And if that's not the only one, I guess I'd love to see these. I mean, there should be a list. You'd need a list of 20 of those to make $1 million, and you need a list of 20,000 of those to make $1 billion. And I haven't seen a list of 10 things like that, let alone 20,000 of them. So in terms of the total dollars, the important thing is the public is, I would argue, very critical and on the edge of being cynical about government spending, probably crossing the line more and more people to believing that it's all such a terrible, corrupt waste. And again, I can give you other examples. All members of the Minnesota Senate got new leather chairs for their offices 2 years ago, I guess. I was told that they got a stupendous deal, and I asked one of the people in the supply office how much they cost. And they said, well, these would be $2,500 chairs if you bought them on your own. They're big, massive leather office chairs, and they were $1,000 a piece. $1,000 will take care of a kid on WIC for a couple of years, the Women, Infant, Children Nutrition Program. And I'd argue, rather than get those chairs, we could certainly do with the old ones a bit longer and save the money. Of course, these will last a lifetime. That's what they said about the old ones 20 years ago, and the leather is wearing thin on the armrests and so on. But I said no to mine, and I'm sure they ordered enough chairs for every member of the Senate, so I'm sure it's sitting in a supply room somewhere for when I leave office and my successor comes in, he can have a nice one too. But I didn't send out any press releases on that. I didn't try and make political hay out of that. because I didn't want to feed the cynicism, but I also think it was an unfortunate waste of money. And I can point out a handful of things, and there are a lot of them. There are a lot of things in government I would do differently, but I think that the important thing for us to do right now is to try and skimp on some of the things like that that one might call an extra or a nice deal. Minnesota, I think, happens to have one of the most beautiful state capitals in the country. And they brag about it, and it truly is a nice work of art. And they treat it that way, and they're remodeling it to make it more historically accurate and so on. But 4 years ago when we came back from Holden, we drove through Bismarck, North Dakota, and their state capitol, it's kind of ugly actually, it looks like a capitol building in place of a dome. It's got a skyscraper, an office tower in the middle. And they brag that per square foot, it's the cheapest state capitol in the country. And, you know, I kind of think that if we as a state want to brag about something, it shouldn't be about the beauty of our capitol. I'm not going to knock it and say we should sell it or something like that. We should be trying to brag about the fact that we're the only state that takes care of poor kids who don't have health insurance. I think some of those things ought to be the priorities we have. And I was kind of pleased to see that South Dakota brags about that in their little brochure. North Dakota, that they brag about the low cost of their state capital and how efficient they were. But again, all of those things tend to be small potatoes types of things. Some of the big potatoes are some of the projects I would argue we shouldn't do. I'm a very strong advocate of mass transportation. I think that the Twin Cities area, like any other big city in the country, we're pretty stupid in terms of the way we plan for transportation. We do almost no planning. And one of the big proposals that's been out there for 15, 20 years has been to put in a light rail transit system. I happen to initially have thought that was a pretty good idea because I'm a big transit proponent, and buses have only like about 3% of our daily passengers in the Twin Cities take bus. And we have what some people would say a relatively good bus system, though it's declining over the years because of lack of funding. Proposal was for a $2 billion mass transit system, LRT system, in the next several years, next two decades it would take to build the whole thing. And I was in favor of this because I thought it was a good idea until I read the ridership estimates of the proponents of it. They said that it would take about 2.5% as opposed to the current 3% of the Twin Cities ridership 20 years from now after we spend $2 billion on it. And that's not much. I think we should be aiming to get 10, can we dream 15, 20, 30% of our auto passengers into transit over a 20-year period? I mean, this is our dream. This is if the entire system is built according to plan. But their numbers are that 2.5% would be taking light rail transit in 20 years from now if we build the whole system. And when you factor out the people already taking bus that would be switching from the bus lines to the light rail lines, it means it would be less than 0.5% of the riders 20 years from now in the Twin Cities would be taking, would be added to mass transit because we built this light rail system. And for the entire, for the capital cost alone of this thing over the next 20 years, it's $2 billion is $100 million a year, we could run our entire bus system free of charge. Right now the fare box brings about $35 million a year in the Twin Cities, so we could take just 1/3 of the capital cost of the new system, use it to have all the rides free. We could add, we could double the number of buses and have more frequent service, better service, things like that. I would argue, and we could buy all clean fuel buses, which would make the environment much better. I would argue that those things are a far wiser investment, but the public is right now about 80% in favor of light rail transit because the assumption they're making that you go down to the corner, you get on the train, it takes you to work and 15 minutes and it sounds great, but you look, tell people, look where the stations are going to be on this thing, and well, I would have to go halfway to work before I could park my car and ride the transit system. It would take me 35 minutes when I can get all the way to work in 20 minutes by car right now. And frankly, most people aren't going to do that, which is why the numbers didn't show it. Our population is not densely located enough to do a fixed rail system very well. So I would argue that the types of things that you have to avoid doing are often very popular things. I think if light rail transit succeeds, which is not clear yet, it will be because 80% of the public says they want it. I think if you show them the numbers, the reason they support it is because they expect everybody else is going to be riding it, if not themselves. And if you show them that it's only going to take an additional 0.5% of the ridership in there, in a 20-year period when traffic congestion is going to grow by 15-20%, we're losing ground over those 20 years, and would they be willing to fund that? I doubt it. But those are the kinds of bigger issues that we have to get to if we're going to hold down spending in areas where we shouldn't be necessarily spending money. The other argument I would say about taxes that make people want to have a tax revolt is the fact that they feel they're paying an unfair burden. I would suggest that the working poor and lower middle income people object to taxes because they feel tax increases, because they feel there's no dollars left to do it. And a lot of people who are literally struggling to survive paycheck to paycheck are in that position. And where am I going to get the money to pay for a tax increase? So they're concerned about it. Middle class people see the rich have tax loopholes, and we're the ones who pay the real burden, so they object to them for that reason. And everybody from working poor, lower, middle, and high-income people object to, we've worked hard for what we've got, and we don't want to pay another penny for lazy bums who are on welfare and are too lazy to work. And I would argue that the combination of that, all those things are some way of saying, this is my share, I'm paying more than my fair share of taxes, and I object to paying that. And there is not a perception out there that our tax system is fair. In Minnesota a couple of years ago, the state, which does a lot of local, all of our local government revenue comes from property taxes or from state aid. And the state aid is basically designed to hold down property taxes. About 3 years ago, the legislature pumped an extra significant amount of money, I think $300 million, into the system, which was a significant boost, more than inflationary increase in state aid to local governments. And the minority leader in the House of Representatives spoke to our local government officials in the League of Cities, our state city officials meeting in convention a month later, and asked city officials who thought their cities had been cheated by the plan to raise their hand. Virtually everybody in the room raised their hands. They can't all be cheated if more money is going into the system. They can't all be getting an unfair deal. But the suburbs think that greater Minnesota is getting the best end of the deal. Greater Minnesota thinks the inner cities are, and the inner cities think the suburbs are. Everybody thinks somebody else is making off at their expense. And if this is elected officials at the local level thinking the state's treating them that way, what's the public at large supposed to think? They all, too, think they're being cheated. Both their community's paying more than its fair share of taxes, their income category is paying more than its fair share of taxes. Everybody is naturally suspicious because we're getting to the stage where people are getting more and more close to the cynical level of government rather than the critical level. And I would suggest that once you get to the feeling that you feel you're being cheated some way or another, you lose all your willingness to pay. And I've heard many people say, I'm willing to pay my fair share, but I don't want to pay somebody else's share too. One of the things that I would say makes the system, you're never going to get rid of all the arguments against taxes. You're never going to make people happy. I don't like to pay taxes. I do it, and I voted for some tax increases in the last 5 years and would do so again, and I'm not pleased to have to do it, but I think that when you have to make a tough decision, you have to draw the line on what's reasonable. Is our tax system fair? I would argue it's not. I'd say the one tax we have that's a fair tax is the income tax. In Minnesota, the business community lobbies very hard against the state income tax. And every time we have extra revenue, they argue for cutting the income tax. Every time we need to increase revenue, they either argue we don't need to, or if we do, it should be sales or property taxes. And I would argue that those are the less fair taxes, more often regressive. Progressive taxes are defined taxes that are a heavier tilt towards those who are better able to pay, regressive ones that hit the lower income people more. And if you look state by state, the comparison of taxes, two-thirds of the states have tax burdens that would be very regressive, to the point of saying people in the lower income categories, the lowest fifth of the population in income, are paying as much as 3, 4, 5 times as much as a percentage of their income is the wealthiest fifth of the population. Minnesota happens to be much less regressive than other states. Our lowest, the highest taxpayers percentage of their income are middle income people in Minnesota. The wealthiest people are about 1% lower, and the poor are slightly above the wealthy in terms of the burden they pay. I would say that that's not a real fair way to do it. I would suggest not a soak the rich kind of policy, but that people at the high end could afford an extra percent or two over what low income people are paying. And the one tax we have in Minnesota that's fair is the income tax. And in Minnesota, if your income is over $20,000 per person, or about $30,000, $25,000 for a married couple, you're in the same tax bracket that somebody earning $3 million a year is in. And I'd argue that's not a wildly progressive system for the one tax that is progressive. And at the federal level, our income tax is somewhat progressive, but it's counterbalanced by the fact that Social Security is a regressive tax. Once you get to 50,000, 50-some thousand a year, you don't pay any more taxes on any income above that. We have certain home mortgage deductions, tends to be a regressive thing. If you're wealthy and have a $500,000 home, or, well, in Minnesota that's wealthy. In some states that may not be that wealthy. But if you have a couple of homes and $500,000 home or something, you get much more benefit out of that tax exemption, than tax deduction, than you do if you're, well, if you're renting, certainly you don't get any. Healthcare deductions, which we talked about last night during the healthcare forum, all those kinds of things make the system less progressive. So I would argue that if we're going to raise taxes, it ought to be in a more progressive way. And I actually took the stand this year. Minnesota had a $1.2 billion shortfall for the next budget period, the one that we were working on the budget for this past session. And there were a number of tax bills introduced, probably about 30, 40 bills this year that dealt with taxes. I will guess all but about 4 of them were tax cuts. They weren't going to go anywhere, and everybody knew that, but somebody drops in the bill to say, I propose cutting taxes on this kind of property, or I propose cutting income taxes, or I propose this. And with a $1 billion shortfall, you're not going to be cutting taxes, but they drop them in anyway so they can tell their constituents how they were the chief author of a bill that was going to cut their taxes, and unfortunately the other jerks at the legislature wouldn't pass the thing. There were a couple bills that raise taxes. The House Tax Committee had one, and the Senate Tax Committee had one as part of the budget balancing plan. About half the money came from spending cuts, the other half went from tax increases. And I and one other, I happen to be a Democrat, and one Republican from Greater Minnesota are the only two people other than the tax committees who offered bills that would have increased taxes. Both of our bills were very similar. Both of them would have raised a higher, put in a new higher rate on incomes over $100,000 a household. And he dropped his in and got one little press release on his, and he gave me the companion bill to his for the Senate, and I dropped it in and then decided to do another one that was slightly different. And mine would have increased taxes more than his, and I actually took the, I'll call it a, given the title of this, this seminar, Raising Taxes, the Easy Way to Lose Elections, I did something that one might argue is foolish. Not only did I drop in this, quote, largest tax increase bill proposed this year, but I actually sent a statement to the press on why I was doing it. And I made two arguments. One was that the tax proposal on mine was a lot fairer than seeing a lot of homeowners have $300 tax increases on their property taxes, which, again, as I said, are very regressive taxes. I argued that hitting high-income people who have gotten the benefit from all the tax cuts in recent years, that was a fair way to do it. And then number two, why was I proposing to raise more money through this system than the tax committees were doing, and then I knew the governor was likely to sign. And I suggested that I thought there were some things government should do that would save money by investing in things now. And this is based on my belief that despite all the rhetoric about government spending, most of it is necessary, and most of it is strongly supported by large majority of both parties. And I say that based on the fact that if both of the public at large would say, yeah, I think we should do that, we should get rid of the other waste, if you give them an example, funding for local schools. Yeah, we should do a good job there. No, we shouldn't be cutting that budget and get rid of the other waste. If you pick those kinds of things and you ask politicians of both parties and what they're telling their constituents, I come to the conclusion, and it's my own belief as well, that most of the spending government does is both necessary and desired by a strong majority of both parties. That's not to say everything is, and I've given a couple of examples, only one larger one, of something that I would argue against, and I can give more, but that's not the purpose of what I'm trying to say right now. But when we're cutting budgets, which every government is doing on and off, maybe not every year, but federal government has made major cuts in the last decade, state governments have, local governments have, the first things that get cut are the, quote, non-necessities. And the non-necessities are often some of the programs that ought to be most desired for a couple of reasons. One, for humanitarian purposes, and number two, because they are what we might call prevention programs. They address a problem head-on, they spend money to save money later. And I can give umpteen examples of them. Early childhood education, the most popular of which is the Head Start program, which is basically, in most states, solely federally funded. And we have 25-year studies that compare Head Start kids to non-Head Start kids from similar backgrounds. It shows we have a reduction in crime because of it. We have a reduction in increase in employment among those kids later on. We have major cuts, major savings in educational, special education costs later on. There are a whole, I'd argue the crime reasons alone, we ought to want to invest money in it, but it more than pays for itself in the education savings later on in life alone by something like a 4-to-1 ratio. Why don't we fund more than a third of the kids who are eligible for Head Start? Well, we don't have the money. So we're saving a few bucks now to pay more later. The WIC child nutrition program, I think it's agreed upon by people of both political parties that it's, the numbers are fairly certain that we save more than $3 in health care costs later on by giving infants and young children adequate nutritional supplies. And it's limited only to milk products and egg products and cheese products and grapefruit juice. And there are very few products that are eligible for the WIC program, but they are all clearly nutritional program benefit things for young children who are most vulnerable to malnutrition and brain damage because of that. It saves $3 for every dollar we invest, most of it very quickly. And why don't we fully fund that? That's funded in Minnesota to less than half the need. Well, we can't afford to. Same thing with energy conservation programs. We know from the early 70s some of the investments states made and local governments made in terms of insulating public buildings, that we got some savings, a lot of savings from those minor investments back then. We could do far more by making the same investments now, but we don't have the money for it. Health prevention programs, all kinds of things, family intervention and child abuse prevention programs. Not only do they prevent crime, but also all the other breakup of the family kinds of things we have, but we don't have the money for them. These are not the urgent things. If there's something we can do about crime, well, we now have to pay the consequences of not preventing the crime that is preventable. We're never going to abolish crime. But if we could do something to hold it down, we won't have to pay for more prisons later. But what's the urgency right now? Well, we got to fund the people who are too dangerous to let out into society now. So the first thing we have to do is make sure we fund the prisons. And once we funded the prisons at $30,000 a person a year, we don't have the money to prevent the prevention for later on. And so I sent out, when I introduced this big tax increase bill, that I sent out a press statement arguing that not only were certain of these things very humanitarian, I picked more money, not fully funding the Head Start program because, well, I'm not going to be unrealistic, but more funding for Head Start, more funding for the WIC program, an $8 million child abuse prevention program. I picked out a whole list of things that I thought we ought to do with the funding, and argued that that was a wise investment, that that was fiscally responsible, when the people who want to save a few bucks this year in order to, but at the cost of paying more down the road, I argued that was more fiscally responsible. I was interested that I got no coverage about this thing. I think they, I don't know whether they were trying to protect me or not, but I didn't get any coverage about this press statement or about this bill this session. And I would suggest that since Walter Mondale's talk in 1984 to the Democratic National Convention that he was going to raise taxes, no politician is opening their mouth about taxes. And I confess that when I, not such a big deal speaking here at Holden, but when I tell my constituents these things, there's a certain amount of trepidation in my mind when I do that, because I look among my colleagues, I don't hear anybody saying this, and I don't hear anybody saying it in any state. Our governor, the opposite political party than myself, gave a State of the State speech this year in which he talked about how we were going to do, he would far rather spend $2,600 on a kid for Head Start than $30,000 a year in a prison later on. And he made a powerful speech, and I agreed with all those things he was saying in there. His budget didn't follow up on that, though, because we couldn't afford to. And all my colleagues did the same thing. So I, when we finally came to voting on the tax bill, I waited till all the other rhetoric in which the minority was criticizing the majority for excessive tax increases and wasteful spending. And I gave a 20-minute speech on why I thought we ought to be honest with ourselves about it. And the fact that I think our constituents, and again, I'm banking heavily on the fact that this is true, that our constituents aren't stupid, that they can accept arguments like this, and that I can talk with people about the idea that certain taxes may be a good investment if we spend it in the right way to do it. But again, it's a risk, and I'm not sure, I've never tried going out there and saying that I think some money should be invested more wisely. But I gave a speech to my colleagues, and I heard some from both parties who said, yeah, I said some things that ought to be said. But I told them that I thought, I raised a piece of my opponent's campaign literature and told him what he was saying about me, how I spent far too little and taxed way too much, and told him that I thought if they looked at their own campaign literature, they'd see the same thing in there, in which they were claiming they were going to spend more and tax less too, and that they ought to be honest with their constituents about it, and that I think the public can accept that. They may not accept everything I agree, and I don't expect that, but I think they'd much rather hear somebody talking that way than people telling them double talk about we're going to cut taxes and spend more at the same time. Having said that, I hope this generates a lot of discussion, because it should, and it is a controversial topic. And again, it's not without some trepidation. I mean, of all the talks I've given here at Holden, this isn't something that I'm keeping as a secret and just coming out here to say. I say the same thing back home, but I say it with the same trepidation here as I do back home. And so I guess I'd like to hear responses and comments. And
I'm going to remember that when I go back.
Criticism. Okay.
I think that there are some people that I've talked to that are saying that we should raise taxes. I mean, and they aren't people that are politician types, but they're just kind of general public that believes that.
Anybody else hearing the same kind of thing?
There is a legislator from this state who comes to Holden, and in fact I met him here, and he happens to be a Republican, and he was dead set against raising taxes, and he said the only fair tax for us to do is, and he said this with a straight face, a nickel or whatever for everyone, a nickel, 5 cents on every bread, loaf of bread sold. And at first glance I thought, yeah, sure, but then after just seconds of thought I realized that's, I at least I think it's extremely less than short-sighted, and in fact, it's kind of devious to do that, to impose the same tax on someone who has very little to buy a loaf of bread with, and someone who can buy a bushel of bread at each shopping spree. I wanted to hear your reply to that.
In terms of, again, I argue very much for a progressive tax system, and I think as a nation and as even our state, which is a more progressive state in terms of tax policy than Washington is, I would argue our taxes are far too regressive right now. And Minnesota does not sales tax food, clothing, or most health care things. Non-prescription drugs other than aspirin, to be technical, we do sales tax. Everything else, aspirin types of pain relievers and prescription drugs, we don't. Other drugs we do. But other than that, food, clothing, and drugs, we do not sales tax. And I think that's a good policy because it makes the system fair. The attempt there was to take the necessities of life and not tax them. When I heard that the top 1% of Minnesotans in family income average, and this is not the bottom of that bracket, but the top 1% of Minnesota households in terms of wealth, based on a joint filer, married joint filing tax returns, the average income of the top 1% of those households is $700-some thousand a year. I frankly think an extra 1% tax on them, $7,000 on them, is not a heavy burden to pay. It's not that, again, I don't want to go in there and argue some outrageous kind of soak the rich kind of scheme, but it seems to me that's a whole lot fairer than taking somebody who's earning minimum wage or just above minimum wage, doesn't have health insurance because they can't afford it, isn't making ends meet in any other way, and raising their tax, they eat presumably roughly the same amount of bread as somebody in the $700,000 a year income category. And I just would strongly disagree with that philosophy. I happen to think that not only is it fair, but I don't think all wealthy Minnesotans or people in the country object to it. And I'm not going to doubt that most of them object to it. But who is it? H. Ross Perot, the billionaire, I saw him quoted on, I don't know whether it was Nightline or something, last year when Congress put on a tax that was first increase in progressivity in our taxes in probably 15, 20 years at the federal level. Last fall, they put on several luxury tax items and effectively closed some loopholes for wealthiest Americans. And they were interviewing him. Peter, I don't know who it was, whether it was Ted Koppel or whether it was some news program, but they were interviewing him. What did he think about this? It was going to mean a lot of additional taxes. He said, well, frankly, I think it's kind of about time. We haven't been paying our fair share for a long time, and, well, if they're going to start doing it now, it seems fair to him. And I don't make the argument that that's the typical high-income person's attitude towards it, but I think there are a lot of people who understand that there is some fairness in that. And given the way the market works, where we have athletes who earn $3-4 million a year, if society wants to pay them that much, that's a judgment society makes, and that may not be perfectly fair in some people's eyes, but that's the way society works. But is it really unfair to tax them a little bit higher rate than somebody else?
As part of the tax, as I remember it, as part of the tax package in Minnesota, there was an increase in sin tax as well. Mm-hmm. Tobacco, alcohol. Can a state, what would prevent a state from declaring gasoline use, gasoline form of sin tax, and raising the tax on gasoline, mm-hmm. a large
Minnesota didn't raise it this year. Minnesota has a higher than average gas tax.
And encouraging people.
Not Minnesota's.
Washington.
That was federal.
I'm not talking. I'm talking about the gallon.
Yeah, that's been proposed. It's been proposed mainly at the federal level. It would be
very
dollar gallon. Well, see, the European countries, if you pay most countries of the world, if you pay that kind of rate on taxes, on gasoline, most countries elsewhere pay far, far higher gasoline tax than Americans pay. I would say a state, there's no way a state could realistically do that. The nation could certainly do it, and there have been proposals, I hear usually 50 cent a gallon tax increase, and I heard it often during Persian Gulf War days that when the gas prices were so high that as soon as we knew they were going to start falling, now is the time Congress should slap one in and people would be accustomed to it. And the arguments in favor of that are, I'll give you the arguments as I see it on both sides. The argument in favor of it is that it certainly does something to consumption and is a move towards energy conservation. It would be a great way to do it. It would discourage purchase of smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles.
That's when you get light rail in.
And less driving. You might, I mean, we got to do a lot of things. If we increased parking fees in downtown areas in big cities, that would help get more people into transit. But with the gas tax thing, it certainly would do something for consumption, plus it would raise a lot of money. The downside is some people, Domino's pizza delivery people, often have to provide their own car, and they're not, the rates they're reimbursed really don't cover mileage. They're given the money for their job, and it may be a buck an hour higher because of it. Some people have, salespeople and so on, have heavy reliance on their car and not much alternative to it, and in a sense, it's a regressive tax.
Look at the poor guy that has to hold down possibly 2-3 jobs to make it by. He doesn't have the time to take mass transit. But frankly speaking, unless it's a really bad congested area, it takes more time to take mass transit. If you've got a half an hour to get from this job to that job, the bus is going to take you 45 minutes. You got to drive.
And with that point, on the regressive nature of that, a lot of people who, you can't take transit in some places, and there are a lot of people, as you point out, working 2-3 jobs, all of them at maybe minimum wage while trying to support themselves, and gas tax is not the fairest way to go because of that. There are some proposals that I think would make some sense, and I could eagerly support it if we put in a gas tax increase and some sort of credit or something. It would have to be an ongoing thing. It couldn't be an end-of-the-year payback, but to the income tax. I would argue that I don't mind certain regressive taxes to accomplish a social policy like that, as long as our overall tax policy is more progressive than it is now. But if we keep going ahead, and I mean, I've carried a lot of legislation that smokers would not really like in Minnesota. The tobacco industry is not considering me a friend. And I'm not real big on raising cigarette taxes a lot more, because I used to be more in favor of it than I am now, because I've seen the studies that I've seen earlier that argue that teenagers were less likely to start if the price were higher. Basically, there hasn't been, the newer things suggest that isn't true. And people who are addicted to cigarettes, which I think is very unfortunate, and it's a high priority of mine to do something about protecting the public from smokers, get clean air, and stop kids from starting to smoke, and helping adults who want to quit to quit. But having said that, they are addicted to it. It's addictive as any kind of other substance. And a whole lot of them are low income, and they're paying a pretty heavy price on it now. So I have real reluctance to go far, even on some social policy things I'd like to do. I'd like to discourage it by raising the price on it. But in the context of a regressive tax system, I have real qualms about going further in that, or gas tax or whatever. But I agree with you, there's a real good social policy for doing that, and it does raise a lot of money.
I would like to ask about, going back to the waste issue. Uh-huh. You talked about a lot of the typical waste that everybody talks about. Mm-hmm. $4,000 ashtrays, $2,500, $1,000 leather chair for the senators. Something that I saw as an interesting idea was eliminating what I call multiple bureaucracies. Mm-hmm. Where it comes to, I read a statistic in a textbook a bunch of years back, so I don't know how worthwhile it is now, that when you added up all the in-kind transfers of all the money that we pay out in taxes to the poor, to the needy, to anybody that needs it,
for every dollar that we spend, it was like 32 cents actually makes it to that person. Now, this is a bunch of years back. Mm-hmm. But the reason they said that it was stated was we have so many bureaucracies that are involved in that, between welfare and unemployment and food stamps, and all of which taken individually are wonderful. But couldn't we
do things more efficiently
all together?
Yeah.
And have one, maybe two, maybe three bureaucracies instead of 10 or 15 or 20 accomplish the same thing.
Okay.
And maybe get that up to 70 cents.
Let me make several points in response to that. First of all, in terms of the 30 cents going to the poor from every dollar, whatever. And again, I hadn't seen that number, so I can't see how to respond to it exactly. But I will make two things. One, a lot of things we do for low-income people are not income transfer things. A lot of counseling types of things, other things that are services provided to them, not economic services, but counseling, job training, other things. If you count that in, that's the only way I could see somebody making the argument 30% is getting to them. Administrative cost of administering and income transfer programs will be better than 70 cents on the dollars going to the recipient of it. But having said that, if it's 75 cents and it could be 85 cents or 95 cents or 99 cents, I'd argue with you that it's a wise thing to do. But let me tell you the reason that that doesn't happen, namely distrust. I mean, we could get more money from income taxes by auditing more people. I mean, if we doubled the number of people we audited, we would raise, I think, better compliance would raise more money than the cost of those additional audits. We spend more money to prevent cheating in welfare programs, which is also an income transfer between government and public. It's the other way around, instead of the public transferring it to the government. If there's fraud there, it's still the same loss of revenue to the government that if there's fraud where somebody's taking double food stamps or something like that. But the point is, because of the lack of trust about the concern that people are cheating with it, that's why there's such a great cost. The food stamp program has more bureaucracy because you got to pay the retailer, you got to have the transfer between the retailer and the government, the consumer and the retailer, and the government and the consumer. You have three transactions instead of, if we just gave them a grant, then they'd be purchasing food the same as everywhere else, and there would be two transactions. Why don't we do that? Well, because we don't want the poor to be spending their money on cigarettes or alcohol or whatever else, so we do it that way. I would argue that we could save a lot of money by a good welfare reform proposal, but there is the potential. We'd be trusting people to spend the money on worthwhile things. So that's been a conscious decision that makes those programs less efficient. In terms of bureaucracy in general, a big thrust this year has been, why do we have to have city government and county government? Why can't we in Minnesota combine the two? Why can't local governments merge with each other and be more efficient? And a number of programs, incentives, and studies for governments were passed this year. I'm very skeptical of massive savings from them, or even any savings, because there may be some in the long term. I'm not sure about that. School districts in Minnesota, a lot of the rural ones are tiny districts. And so this year, well, rather than have a superintendent for each one, for the last 5 or 6 years, we've been trying to get them to consolidate. And we do all kinds of things we're working more and more towards forcing them to. And the one thing we find out is the bigger the district, the more course offerings they can offer, which they ought to have. They got to have certain science courses to compete in the modern world for college preparatory classes in high school. So by merging districts, we can give them better services, but does it save money when you factor in the cost, the additional transportation costs and other things? So far, we're spending more money to get them to consolidate than they're saving in terms of once the consolidation occurs. I'm just saying that it's a close call on whether you should make some of those consolidations or not. Certainly there is redundant bureaucracy in places. It's some of the hardest stuff to get rid of. In other words, I'm saying there's waste in government. It's not always real obvious, and it's also often politically difficult because the employees in each of those bureaucracies fight it hard. And it's not always clear whether there's going to be a savings from
more
doing
more difficult to deal with that than it is to deal with trying to raise taxes, which we are also saying is difficult.
True.
And is it perhaps more beneficial to go after some of those difficulties than to try and raise taxes?
I'd argue you try and go after both things. You don't. I think you have to go waste at every level for the both for the dollar amount involved. And also for the bad will it spreads among the public that they're feeling cheated. And I think because of that, even if we spend a dollar to root out a dollar of waste in government, it's worth doing if it's an even break because of the bad PR it gets. But having said that, I think cutting waste is a high priority of mine. Because of both those things. One, because we need the money for better things. And two, because of that. I'm just telling you that I think it's first of all, in terms of redundant bureaucracy, which there is some, and I can point out some that I think we ought to get rid of and do. Several of the cities in my district have been cooperating. They share fire departments, they share police services now, and they've been working on this. But they've backed out of one or two of them because they found out, hey, it wasn't cheaper for them to do for variety of reasons, and they've been saying, hey, look, we're trying to consolidate anyway. Don't force us into it in an unreasonably quick manner that's unfair to us. And that's what I'd say. We need good administrators and people who are willing to make those tough decisions, and we have to keep fighting for that. My whole point is, while we're doing that, it's not like you're going to save 70 cents on the dollar. You can, and it's worth saving it, save 5 cents on the dollar at times. And 5 cents on the dollar is worth saving. I'll keep talking more because I think there are some more discussion here, but it is 1:45 by my watch, so I'll call a formal quit for the Tate Minister. Thank you very much, and I will sit right here and can keep asking questions till we have to go to Vespers. Yes?
Well, one thing, in our county, we live in Washington, Jerry, we're the fastest growing county, not only in Washington, but in the United States. And because of that, people are coming in, they've got the money, and they're paying overpriced for the house. We were revalued a year ago, and our house went, well, there goes your taxes. Well, the average person has gotten so, how are they going to get into a home? How can you stop it? Just because people are moving in there. We live in where Boeing, the big Boeing plant, and they've got other industries that are coming in. Well, this is going to bring in.
Yeah.
Back last year, they had 18,000 license plates that were changed from other states that moved in. Well, some come with money, and this makes your home.
And their home prices are, you're having the same thing that California has been having for a couple of decades. I mean, a house in the Twin Cities area, that's $70,000 in San Francisco, you can't get for $250,000. I mean, it's outrageous difference. And what do you do about it? That's one of my arguments about how the property tax is a grossly unfair system. I believe Washington does not have an income tax,
but that's correct.
Which means you pay a lot heavier part of your tax burden out of property taxes. And the sad thing about that is one community, I don't know how it exactly works here, but if it's anything like Minnesota, you've got real problems because one community has a strong tax base to fund the schools and so on. So they may be paying half the tax rate of the next community. And then on top of that, you have the increasing valuation of your houses, which hits people who are on an income that's about maybe going up like this, or fixed income, which inflation adjusted means it's going down, and their taxes go up at an even faster rate. And that's one of my arguments about why income taxes are a lot fairer than property taxes. But there isn't much you can do because the tax assessment's going to keep going up. California, I believe, until some point fairly recently had it, maybe it's still the case, where as long as you live in the house, they don't up the assessment on it. But then you get somebody who stays in the house for 30 years and they're paying...
We do ours.
Yeah. Well, ours goes up every year, too. But any states that don't,
fantastic, we can handle it.
Yeah.
But you take the real elderly. We have a gentleman that's going to be 90, and he retired at 65.
And had a poor pension at the time.
Poor
pension.
It doesn't go up at all.
It's grossly unfair.
And maybe they'll be able to stay there, and maybe they won't because things are just getting out of hand.
And that's one of the arguments I make on why the nature of the taxes we pay are as important as how much we pay, because there are two people, one gets laid off, two people working in the next house to each other in the same job, one gets laid off or retires and the other one doesn't, and their ability to pay shifts dramatically. Do we really want to chase a 90-year-old guy out of his house? No, and frankly, in most states, that means he goes into a nursing home, loses his life savings in 2 weeks, and the state picks up the tab. That's a stupid public policy as well as inefficient one.
One comment on the 90-year-old, there are certain provisions locally, well, statewide, in fact, that allow for...
they get a little rebate.
Well, there's even a non-collection if they can't afford it. But it is a lien against the house.
Oh, a lien?
No, it's the state of Washington.
You can do a lien against the house?
Yeah. It's a situation where there's a deferment of that tax if you're under a certain level of income. Anyway, that's...
Yeah.
The other...
Those are kind of... patch and repair types of things to
feed
the damage, but it can help.
It robs the family, however, of any form of...